Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 16th, 2018 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows Uncle Sam. He is riding a bull and holding on for dear life. His hat's flying off and dollars are flying through the air. Looks like he's probably on Wall Street. The headline is "A Rougher Ride Ahead." After a long run-up, the bull market gets volatile. Go on from there to our main stories. The first one, Congress closes in on a long-term budget deal. What happened? Senate leaders this week announced a sweeping two-year budget deal that would avert an imminent government shutdown and set the stage for a separate floor debate over the immigration reform in the coming weeks. The bipartisan agreement would add some $400 billion in military and domestic spending, including $6 billion to fight opioid addiction and $90 billion in disaster relief, likely bringing the 2018 budget deficit to $1 trillion. It would also lift the debt ceiling through March 2019. But it was unclear whether the measure would pass the House, where Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi threatened to torpedo the deal, which is opposed by conservative deficit hawks, unless House Speaker Paul Ryan also guaranteed a lower chamber vote on the fate of the undocumented Dreamers. President Trump said he would love to see a shutdown if lawmakers failed to include tough new immigration measures in their deal. The White House later walked back Trump's comments. Lawmakers were embroiled in separate immigration negotiations ahead of a March 5th deadline when the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals DACA program is set to expire, threatening some 700,000 young immigrants with deportation. Senators John McCain, the Republican from Arizona, and Chris Coons, Democrat from Delaware, proposed a bare-bones solution that would grant DACA recipients citizenship in exchange for added border security. The White House rejected that plan because it did not address Trump's demands for $25 billion in border wall funding, an end to the diversity visa lottery, and restrictions on family-based immigration. Any DACA deal that did not include the desperately needed wall, tweeted Trump, is a total waste of time. What the editorial said. It's easy to dismiss Trump's immigration stance as a gratuitous cruelty, said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger, but Democrats would be foolish to ignore the president's generous offer, a pathway to citizenship for 1.8 million Dreamers who were brought illegally to the U.S. as children in exchange for a wall and caps to legal immigration. Remember, the president has all the leverage in the immigration debate. He knows Democrats will be punished in the midterms if they allow vulnerable Dreamers to be kicked out of the country. McCain-Coons would protect just as many Dreamers, said Bloomberg.com, and provide better border security than a wall built willy-nilly at fantastic expense. The bipartisan legislation would authorize the Department of Homeland Security to develop a comprehensive southern border strategy that could include physical barriers, but only if they're really needed. McCain-Coons isn't perfect. It doesn't curb family-based immigration or let in more skilled immigrants. But Congress can either pass a narrowly drawn bill that scores popular wins on two fronts, or it can fail across the board. What the columnist said. With the clock ticking, Congress will probably end up punting on the Dreamer question, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. The latest strategy, known as Plan Z, is to pass a one-year extension to DACA's legal protections. Team Blue can live with one more year of limbo for Dreamers, and by 2019, the party will almost certainly have more power at the federal level than it does today. Republicans are just as reluctant to see Dreamers kicked out before the midterms, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. If they don't find a fix, either temporary or permanent, then the run-up to November's elections will be pockmarked with harrowing scenes. Immigration officials dragging illegal immigrants from homes, workplaces, schools, and presumably the military as well. With those kinds of front-page stories, Republicans can likely kiss goodbye competitive seats in Florida, Texas, and California. Whatever happens in the next few weeks, Trump has already successfully moved the needle on immigration limits, says Ramesh Ponuru in Bloomberg.com. Just a few years ago, senators across the board were proposing higher legal immigration. Now, according to a new Harvard-Harris poll, some 70% of Americans want to end the visa lottery, 80% reject family-based migration, and nearly 80% want secure borders. The bottom line, said Jen Kearns in TheHill.com, is that most Americans agree with Trump's immigration policies, and Democrats' failure to understand this reality may prove to be fatal for them. It's time for our controversy of the week. The FBI, are Republicans at war with law enforcement? Once upon a time, Republicans were the party of law and order and instinctively respected law enforcement institutions, said Philip Rucker and Robert Costa in the Washington Post. Not anymore. President Trump has been openly disparaging the integrity of the FBI and Justice Department ever since he took office, to try to delegitimize the ongoing investigation into his campaign's ties to Russia. But last week, House Speaker Paul Ryan and other Republican leaders joined him in backing the release of Representative Devin Nunes' memo alleging a shadowy FBI Democrat conspiracy against Trump, making the GOP itself an adversary of federal law enforcement. It's hard to overstate how surreal this is, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com. The FBI is one of the government's most conservative institutions, historically staffed and led by white male Republicans and deeply distrusted by liberals. But in the topsy-turvy world Trump has created, hating the FBI could soon be a core part of Republican identity. That claim is utterly bizarre, said Molly Hemingway in TheFederalist.com. Far from criticizing, quote, law enforcement as a whole, Republicans have focused their scrutiny on a handful of FBI and Justice Department officials in leadership positions, including fired FBI Director James Comey, to obtain a surveillance warrant on former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page. Agents used the discredited Steele dossier funded by Hillary Clinton's campaign without fully informing the judge of the information's origins or Steele's animus toward Trump. And then there was the investigation of Hillary Clinton's reckless email practices, which was slow-walked by then-FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, whose Democratic wife got a $467,000 contribution from Clinton associates when she ran for a Virginia Senate seat. Republicans have every right to question the handling of these cases, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. When the FBI intrudes into hot political disputes, no one should be surprised when things get political. The GOP claims it's conducting necessary oversight of a few bad apples, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. But then Trump's most unhinged sycophants proclaim that the Nunes memo reveals a deep state abuse of power that's treason and Watergate times a million. Trump himself tweeted that the FBI has politicized the sacred investigative process in favor of Democrats and against Republicans. Trump's goal, of course, is to undermine public faith in the FBI, Justice Department, and Special Counsel Robert Mueller so that his supporters can dismiss anything that emerges on this scandal, no matter how factual and proven. It's working, said Olivia Beavers in TheHill.com. In a new Reuters poll, 73% of Republicans say the FBI is trying to delegitimize Trump through politically motivated investigations. That's going too far, said Ben Shapiro in NationalReview.com. Yes, there are serious questions to be asked about the conduct of FBI leadership, particularly in its handling of the Steele dossier and its apparent eagerness to end the Clinton investigation without criminal charges. But that doesn't mean the FBI has no reasonable grounds for suspicion about either Page or the Trump campaign's numerous, often secretive contacts with Russia. It also doesn't mean Mueller is somehow responsible for any of this, or that his investigation should be cut short. In their defense of Trump, Republicans should be careful not to destroy the nonpartisan credibility of the FBI or the government surveillance authority. We'll need both long after the Trump presidency is over. And it's time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for making the best of it, with the news that several African countries have incorporated recent comments by President Trump into their tourism campaigns. New ads for Namibia, for example, call it one of the best S-hole countries out there. It was a good week for targeted marketing, after a California Girl Scout managed to sell a staggering 300 boxes of Girl Scout cookies in only 6 hours by positioning herself outside a San Diego marijuana dispensary. And it was a good week for recycling, after a NASA-funded study at the University of Pennsylvania found a method for converting human feces into protein-rich food paste resembling Marmite that could feed spaceship crews on a 3-month flight to Mars. But it was a bad week for another false alarm, after the National Weather Service erroneously sent a tsunami alert cell phone notification to residents of some eastern and southern coastal cities. It was a bad week for Tom Brady, who was trolled on Twitter by deadpan ex-girlfriend Bridget Moynihan as his New England Patriots lost the Super Bowl to the Philadelphia Eagles. Moynihan sent multiple tweets praising Eagles quarterback Nick Foles, as well as a link to a satirical piece, Super Bowl confetti made entirely from shredded concussion studies. And it was a bad week for American exceptionalism, with confirmation from the White House that President Trump has ordered the Pentagon to organize a large-scale parade of military hardware down Pennsylvania Avenue later this year, with tanks, missiles, and marching soldiers. And before we move from here, a boring but important item. At HUD, Carson faces ethics questions. Lawyers for the Department of Housing and Urban Development have warned Secretary Ben Carson that he is in danger of violating federal ethics rules by involving his family in official business. Carson's family members, including his wife, frequently attend HUD meetings and events. And HUD officials were alarmed last summer when Carson's son, Ben Carson Jr., and his daughter-in-law, Marilyn, helped organize an official listening tour in Baltimore. Carson Jr. owns a Maryland-based investment firm, and his wife owns a consulting firm, which was later awarded a no-bid $485,000 contract with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Carson Sr. this week denied any wrongdoing or impropriety. Our briefing page article this week is titled, Wooing Corporations with Public Money. Local governments offer billions in incentives to attract businesses like Amazon. Does that practice pay off? How much is being spent? Tax incentives given to businesses now total $80 billion a year, triple the amount in 1990. These inducements come in the form of income tax credits and exemptions, property tax abatements, land grants, low-interest loans, cash giveaways, and other free services. Major corporations have come to expect generous incentive packages for opening or moving offices or plants, spawning an industry of consultants dedicated to negotiating lucrative offers from local governments. For the largest, highest-profile companies, no negotiation is necessary. After encouraging a nationwide bidding war for its second headquarters, Amazon received proposals from 200 cities to locate the headquarters in Newark, one of the 20 finalists. New Jersey has offered Amazon up to $7 billion in tax breaks, more than the $5 billion the company plans to spend on the project itself. What's the benefit to communities? Incentives are premised on the idea that businesses will hire workers and grow the local economy. Amazon, for example, has promised to hire 50,000 workers at an average salary of $100,000 per year at its new headquarters, a prospect that has nearly every small and large city salivating. Economist Enrico Moretti of the University of California, Berkeley, estimates that the spillover effects could lead to as many as 300,000 new jobs over the next two decades by attracting other technology firms as well as a host of other businesses to service the needs of an affluent workforce. This definitely beats other deals I have seen, to be sure, says Moretti. It would certainly increase the attractiveness of that city for other well-paying high-tech jobs. Amazon, however, is not typical. What usually happens? Economists say that most of the time the incentives are counterproductive, a zero-sum game in which jobs created in one community come at the expense of jobs lost somewhere else. The real winners are companies, which are able to play municipalities against one another so as to be freed of paying taxes, other businesses, and homeowners do. The result is a race to the bottom, leaving cities with less to spend on infrastructure improvements and public education. At the same time, companies increase expenses for communities by drawing on public resources, including sewer systems, roads, power lines, and schooling for workers' children. Last year, Wisconsin pledged $3 billion in incentives to electronics manufacturer Foxconn to build a plant in Racine County that the company says will eventually employ 13,000 workers. But according to Wisconsin's own estimates, the cost to taxpayers per job created is $230,700, and the state won't recoup its investment until 2043. Why offer incentives then? Governments believe that they have no choice. Research suggests that tax incentives are the deciding factor in location decisions less than 15% of the time, with companies giving more weight to transportation costs, housing availability, access to raw materials, and workforce demographics. Nevertheless, civic leaders see not offering incentives as equivalent to unilateral disarmament. if you don't have something on the table, you are going to lose, said G. David Gillick, mayor of North Ridgeville, Ohio. His city recently lured a manufacturing firm with $7 million in incentives. If we said we don't have any incentives, but we have a low income tax rate and we would love to have you, they would not be here. What are the alternatives? Opponents of incentives have long advocated for a federal law banning them, but that seems unlikely to happen. In a rare exception, counties within Ohio and Colorado have agreed to stop competing with one another on incentives, but such agreements are difficult to work out. Leaders in the Kansas City area have tried in vain for years to defuse a border war along the Kansas-Missouri state line, in which both states spend heavily to lure businesses from each other. Since 2009, 6,000 jobs have moved from Missouri to Kansas, while 5,500 jobs have moved from Kansas to Missouri at the combined cost of $321 million in lost tax revenue. When do incentives pay off? When they actually persuade a company to do something it wouldn't do otherwise. Critics of incentives point to New York City's decision to give $10 million in tax incentives to the filmmakers behind Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, even though the film had to be set on Wall Street. Amazon has already received more than $1 billion in incentives from 129 communities, much of it to build distribution centers and data farms that it needed to build anyway. A better use of incentives, critics say, would be encouraging companies to build in a depressed city, to expand existing businesses, or to employ reformed ex-cons who can't otherwise find work. If you spend public money to do those things, those are worthy incentives, said Greg Leroy of Good Jobs First, which tracks corporate subsidies, not subsidies, windfalls, or giveaways. The stadium spending spree. Taxpayers have spent more than $13 billion in tax-free municipal bonds to help build professional sports stadiums since 2000. On average, taxpayers assume 78% of the cost of these stadiums, whose revenues mostly go to the private team owners. The net economic benefits of these generous public incentives, however, are dubious. A recent poll by the Federal Reserve found that 83% of economists agree that sports subsidies cost taxpayers more money than they bring in. Studies show that most of the money stadium goers spend is simply diverted from entertainment money they would have spent on other local businesses, such as movies, concerts, or restaurants. If you ever had a consensus in economics, this would be it, said Michael Leeds, a sports economist at Temple University. A baseball team has about the same impact on a community as a mid-sized department store. In its recently passed tax bill, Republicans nearly banned tax-free status for municipal bonds used to fund stadiums, but the proposal was stripped out of the final version after heavy lobbying from professional sports leagues. Time now to read a few of the columns. The first from the U.S., The Cost of Trump's Reality Show. Donald Trump's presidential reality show has great ratings, said Matthew Iglesias, but it's blinding us to what matters. While the country is engrossed in such spectacles as the Nunes memo and Trump's latest tweet, important news is getting lost. Just a few examples. The Labor Department suppressed a report that the Trump administration's proposed new rule allowing restaurant owners to keep employees' tips could cost workers billions of dollars a year. The Centers for Disease Control is facing an 80% funding cut from its efforts to fight infectious disease outbreaks. in the midst of the worst flu season in years. And there were two major passenger train derailments to serve as a reminder of our crumbling infrastructure. It's not that the media didn't cover those and other important stories, but they were completely drowned out by the Trump show. Sometimes the firestorms the president generates play to his advantage. Other times they backfire spectacularly. But either way, it's an absolute disaster for the understanding of public affairs. Staged stories about what the federal government is actually doing might be less exciting than Trump's Twitter beefs, but they have real impact on real people's real lives. Governing is not a TV show. This column comes from Italy. The migrant crisis is fueling racist violence. The nightmare of racist terrorism has come to Italy, said Antonio Polito. In a two-hour shooting spree last week, far-right extremist Luca Traini drove around the central Italian city of Macerata, opening fire at every dark-skinned person he saw. Five African men and an African woman were wounded in the attack. Traini, who has a neo-Nazi tattoo on his forehead, allegedly gave a Nazi salute as he was arrested, with an Italian flag draped over his shoulders. We must now open our eyes to what Italy is becoming. We have grown inured to hate speech in daily conversation, to a mode of expression that describes those who disagree with us on matters of immigration as the enemy. We must oppose this. Yet we must also recognize that the chaotic, uncontrolled, illegal way immigrants have flooded our cities has provoked resentment and rancor even among decent people. Macerata has become a hub for human trafficking, where African girls are sold to work on the street. And just days before the shootings, the dismembered remains of an 18-year-old Italian girl were found in the city. A Nigerian drug dealer has been arrested in connection with her killing. Does tolerance mean tolerating this? Of course not. It's childish to blame Traini's violence on critics of immigration. We ought to be able to criticize both this untenable migrant situation and criminals who target migrants. And this from Peru. Farmers can't sell their spuds. Peru is having a potato crisis, says Elizabeth Prado and Giovanni Inojosa. Thanks to a bumper harvest, the price of potatoes has plummeted well below the cost of production, and farmers who can't sell their crops are rioting. Farmers blocked roads across the country last week and clashed with police, setting fires. At least two people were killed. The farmers are demanding that the government declare a national state of emergency and allot money to buy all the surplus potatoes at a fair price. And it looks like their demands will be met. But even if those measures resolve this year's crisis, the underlying problem remains. It is a crisis generated by the government itself because of a lack of agrarian planning, says Edwin Miranda, a farmer's rights advocate. Potatoes were first domesticated in Peru, and more than 700,000 families here depend on potato farming for their livelihood. Yet the country lacks any industrial potato processing capability. There's no central facility where the vegetables can be peeled, cut, and bagged for sale to restaurants. That means that even though the potato is a national staple, Peruvian businesses still import processed potato products like frozen French fries from foreign countries. The farmers now want tariffs, and who can blame them? Our in-depth article this week has a Winter Olympic theme to it. The title is Learning to Luge. As a longtime fan of the Olympic luge event, I've often wondered how it would feel to hurtle down an icy steep track with no brakes, said journalist Sarah Larimer. There was only one way to find out. We can start with the suit. It was blue with splashes of red and white. It said USA on the left leg. There were these stirrup feet which felt very 1990s. Sartorially speaking, it was not my sharpest look. But it did make me feel extremely legit. I took three selfies in the mirror after I slipped it on. Dress for the job you want, they say. So here I was in Lake Placid, New York, dressed in my stirrup-footed luge suit. Anthony Shimkonis, my luge spirit guide, slid my feet into the booties, angled to help my toes point. He showed me a pair of gloves with spikes on the fingertips. He mentioned something about safety, how to avoid ripping my hand or whatever. And then reality came crashing down. All right, Shimkonis said, giving me one more check. I think you have the luge suit on backward, actually. So that could have gone better, probably. I had come to Lake Placid to learn to luge. For some time, I had harbored this ambition, a fascination burrowed deep in my head, a whisper of a dream. I believed I could do it, too, which was both deeply weird and tremendously out of character. I am a mediocre athlete with exactly zero luge-related experience. Perhaps more importantly, though, I am also not generally the type of person who goes around believing in herself. But learning this obscure winter sport in, like, a couple of days? Sure. Why not? Anyway, that was how I ended up in the Adirondack Mountains, and more specifically, the parking lot for USA Luge headquarters in Lake Placid. That was where Washington Post video journalist Jorge Ribas and I met up with Shimkonis, the guy who would spend the December weekend trying to make me luge official. Shimkonis, who also went by Tony, is president of the Adirondack Luge Club, a group that helps promote luge, teaches amateurs such as me how to slide, and generally seems to have a killer time doing it. Tony is something of a luge evangelist. He speaks with such joy about this wild sport. The best slider, he likes to say, is the one having the most fun. Right this way for the adventure of your life, Tony said to me in that icy parking lot, and I scampered off with him because I was super ready for the adventure of my life. A quick refresher. Luge is an Olympic sport in which participants maneuver sleds down an icy track. Sliders go feet first, not head first. That's skeleton. Sliders lie on their sleds instead of sitting on them. That's bobsledding. Sliders can reach speeds of, well, it's fast. Really, really fast. Also, there are no brakes. Of all the sliding sports, luge is the best. This is possibly more of an opinion than a fact, but you can watch them all this month and decide for yourself. It's really about control, said Larry Dolan, a 1998 U.S. Olympian and a coach in the USA Luge organization. Can you control your emotions? Can you control your mind? Can you control your body to do what it needs to at 70, 80, 90 miles an hour? Being chill and in control is a pretty important part of launching oneself down a mountain ice chute, as it turns out. People tend to think sliders are these off-the-wall daredevils, said Fred Zimny, junior national team coach. But that type of person doesn't necessarily excel in Olympic-level luge. You don't see a lot of the fringe personalities like you would think involved in luge, Zimny told me. They're actually very normal people. One of the first people we met in Lake Placid was Gordy Shear, director of marketing and sponsorship for USA Luge, who was at the headquarters with his dog, Luna. Shear was very normal, mellow, affable, wore a cool flannel, and also a former Olympian. He and his doubles luge partner, Chris Thorpe, took silver at the 1998 Nagano Games, the first year Americans medaled in the sport. Steering is a nuanced act. It looks like you are just lying there. But sliders control the sled by pushing the shoulders down and or pressing their legs against a runner. There are other things they can do too. Head tilts and stuff like that. A good luge athlete, Shear said, has an unusual combination of skills. It's somebody who has good kinetic awareness, body awareness, he said. Someone who is able to relax under some pretty high pressure situations and focus. It's much more of a mental skill once you're actually sliding. Later in the day, Shim Konis went with us to Olympic Sports Complex at Mount Van Hovenberg, where I would take my first run. Young sliders happened to be there, too, for a casual day on the track. You could hear their sleds rumble down the ice. I just get little butterflies and stuff every time I walk up here, Shim Konis said, as we passed under the track. Think of all the athletes that came down this track, hoping for gold. Former U.S. Olympian Aidan Kelly, who now works as a coach and was up on the mountain that day, remembered his first luge run on this very track. It was awesome. I wanted to go faster and faster, Kelly said. I just wanted to keep moving up the track. No nerves? No fear at all? No, he said. I just wanted to go. I just wanted to do it. One of the sliders out of the track was Elizabeth McKissick, a 15-year-old from Pennsylvania who is part of the Adirondack Luge Club. She got her start in luge through a clinic held in Maryland, part of the search program for new sliders. McKissick said the focus the sport requires has helped her deal with anxiety. All that matters is just you and the track, she said. And I love that. McKissick dreams of competing internationally with the ultimate goal of making the Olympics. When she talked about the games, she took off her glasses, overcome. Her eyes welled up. I'm sorry, she said. I can't imagine doing anything else with my life. And I can't imagine what my life would be without luge. My life has just changed so much for the better. I slid on a Saturday night when members of the Adirondack Luge Club gathered at the mountain. Larry Dolan, the coach, came out with his son, an 8-year-old named Gabriel, who wore a bright red suit that had once been his dad's. Do you have any advice? I asked Gabe before we set out. Keep your shoulders down, he replied enthusiastically. Keep your shoulders back, yeah? Larry said. He's a quick study. Journalistically speaking, conditions were subpar. Luge suits don't really accommodate pens, much less notebooks and recorders. I can tell you that the moon was bright and the night was still. It was cold, super cold. My Adirondack wear was also subpar, so that did not help. But also, I had only one layer on under my suit, a slight miscalculation in that I needed, 57 layers. My sled and I would leave from the lowest start on the mountain, which meant I would travel about 540 meters, not the full length of the track. There were six other sliders at the same start, including Gabe and two sisters, Sadie and Tess Martin, ages 10 and 8. It all happened so quickly. Gabe left the start with a push from his father. Sadie went a little later, gliding down after a bit of gentle last-minute coaching from Larry. After Sadie was Tess, whose blonde ponytail poked out of her helmet. Eventually, it was my turn. Shim Konis slid black arm pads up past my elbows, and Dolan moved my sled into position as I wiggled my hands into a pair of gloves. You look really nervous, Dolan said. I sat on my sled and tapped my legs, indicating that these steers that I'd make in the first turns. Exactly, Dolan said. There you go. That'll help you get all the way down. Shim Konis patted me on the back, saying, all right, you're going to get them, Tiger. Then with a push from Dolan, I was off. What can I say? My dudes, it was a marvel, a total joy. Bonkers fun. Also, essentially impossible to describe. but I will do my best. The track felt smooth and true, even though it looked so bumpy on video. The run felt tremendously fast, even though I was going just about 30 miles per hour, not even close to Olympic-level speeds. Somehow, it really was relaxing out there, rocketing through the moonlight. I wanted to go faster and faster. I wanted to never stop. I went down four times, each trip a complete delight. I remember grinning like a goofball basically the whole time. I kept shouting a lot. Who knows why? Scratch that. I know why. Because luge is great. That's why. You did good, Shimkona said the next day. You're coachable. Which I think means I can join the Olympic team now. Before I left for this trip, I talked to some members of the extremely small luge community. I wanted to get a sense of what to expect. Also, I was very interested in not crashing. I wanted some hot tips. Dolan told me that after his last race, luge would still come to him in his dreams. About once a week it happened, he said. Those dreams are a little less frequent now. Shimkona said sometimes when he wakes up, his toes are pointed. Luge position. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. I'm going to read for you today the business column that relates back to our cover story with cover picture with Uncle Sam on the bull. It says, "Stock market, Wall Street's wild ride. President Trump is learning a basic and painful lesson of Wall Street. Stocks also go down," said Ben White in Politico.com. After months of relentlessly citing the market's meteoric rise as proof of his economic prowess, the president was uncharacteristically quiet this week as a swift and historic fall rattled Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plummeted 1,175 points on Monday, its largest ever single-day point drop, as the major global indexes erased their gains for the year. Unusually volatile trading continued throughout the week with a 567-point one-day gain. Monday's precipitous plunge abruptly ended a remarkable period on Wall Street in which it seemed the only direction was up, with investors and most analysts confident that the U.S. and other big economies are on stronger ground than they have been in years. Even cynics had been acting as if the record gains were bulletproof, said Jeff Cox in CNBC.com. But in a dizzying few days of trading, the market took on a mind of its own. Wall Street was overdue for a reality check, said Heather Long in the Washington Post. Between January 2017 and January 2018, the Dow went up 26%. The historical annual average is 8%. It seems only right that investors were beginning to question whether stocks really should be at such high levels. It's also important to remember that the stock market is not the economy, which is doing very well right now with low unemployment and solid growth. If anything, it might have been good news that sent the market into a tailspin, said Catherine Rampell, also in the Post. Last week's jobs report, which showed the economy added $200,000 in January, indicated wages grew by 2.9%, the fastest annual pace since June 2009. That should be cause for celebration. But it could also signal the start of higher prices, that is, faster inflation. Investors are worried that the recent corporate tax cut might actually work too well and overheat the economy, leading the Federal Reserve's new chairman, Jerome Powell, to hike interest rates more quickly than planned to keep a lid on inflation. Another factor spooking traders, an uptick in the federal government's projected borrowing, nearly $1 trillion this year, 84% more than in 2017, as tax receipts fall thanks to the tax cuts. That could also drive up interest rates, making it harder for businesses and consumers to borrow. Stop trying to make sense of the stock market, said Jason Zweig in the Wall Street Journals. In the Wall Street Journal, people don't always act rationally in response to new information. Often they react to nothing but how they think other people will act. Occasional madness is part of the package, and a reminder that investing in stocks doesn't automatically make people rich. It's a message Trump might want to heed, said Peter Baker and Benjamin Applebaum in the New York Times. No president in modern times has connected his political fortunes to the stock market as much as Trump. This week's dive was a vivid demonstration of why past Oval Office occupants have scrupulously avoided taking credit for market rises. If you live by the Dow, you may die by the Dow. We'll catch a couple of the health and science articles this week. The first titled, Monkeys Cloned for the First Time. More than 20 years after Scottish researchers cloned Dolly the sheep, scientists in China have cloned two monkeys, the first time the technique has been used on primates. Since a landmark procedure that produced Dolly in 1996, 22 other mammal species have been cloned, including cows, dogs, horses, and rabbits. But the cloning of long-tailed macaques Hua Hua and Song Song makes it technically possible to use the Dolly method, somatic cell nuclear transfer, to clone humans. Born several weeks ago, the monkeys are identical female twins. For the cloning process, scientists transferred DNA taken from fetal monkey cells into eggs that had their own DNA removed. Then they stimulated these eggs to develop into embryos, which they implanted in female surrogates. The resulting 79 viable embryos led to 6 pregnancies, yielding 2 live births. The researchers called their advance a breakthrough for biomedicine, reports Reuters.com. Producing large groups of genetically identical monkeys could revolutionize research on diseases including cancer, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's. But some bioethicists fear the breakthrough could lead to human cloning, concerns the researchers are dismissing. The technical barrier is now broken, said Mu Ming Pu from the Chinese Academy of Sciences, but we're not going to do it. There's absolutely no plan to do anything on humans. Rethinking human migration. The discovery of a prehistoric jawbone in Israel has added to a growing body of research challenging the long-held theory that modern humans migrated out of Africa about 60,000 years ago. Archaeologists found the upper jaw in Mislia Cave on the western slope of Mount Carmel. Using 3 different dating techniques, researchers at Tel Aviv University determined that the fossil is between 177,000 and 194,000 years old, nearly twice as ancient as previous Homo sapiens remains discovered outside Africa. Found alongside the jawbone were blades and other tools, which the researchers believe must have been made by modern man. The discovery, which has taken 5 years to confirm, is the latest evidence that modern humans may have mingled and mated with Neanderthals for thousands of years. We are now realizing that it was not one big exodus out of Africa in a given time period, lead researcher Israel Hershkovitz tells the New York Times. Rather, there was a flow of hominins coming in and out of Africa for at least the last 5.5 million years. And we are on the Talking Points page. Carter Page, the Kremlin's useful idiot. He is the mysterious aide who just won't go away, said Tom McCarthy in TheGuardian.com. An odd, vehemently pro-Kremlin former Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page triggered the FBI surveillance that's at the center of the controversial Nunes memo. Who exactly is Page? Before joining Trump's campaign, Page, 46, spent years in Moscow as an investment banker and advisor to the state oil firm Gazprom. By 2013, he was back in New York in his new office next to Trump Tower, said Luke Harding in Politico.com. That year, a Russian spy working in New York tried to recruit Page. In recorded conversations, Viktor Portnoy told a fellow agent that Page was an idiot, but that it's obvious he wants to earn loads of money. Portnoy said he would feel the American energy consultant, he would feed the American energy consultant empty promises, pledging to push generous contracts his way in exchange for valuable information. Page communicated with Portnoy for months, later telling the FBI that he didn't realize the Russian was a spy. Fast forward to March 2016, said Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com, when presidential candidate Donald Trump announced that Carter Page, Ph.D., was joining his new foreign policy advisory panel. By July, Page was off to Moscow on a campaign-approved trip. Officially, he was there to give a pro-Russia speech. But in his now famous dossier, former British spy Christopher Steele claims that Page also met with Putin crony Igor Sechin, head of Russia's state-owned oil company, Rosneft, and that Sechin offered Page and or other Trump associates millions of dollars in exchange for ending U.S. sanctions on Russia. When news of Page's Russian connections went public that September, the Trump campaign cast Page out. A month later, the FBI put him under surveillance as part of its growing Russia investigation. Given the unflattering attention he's received, you'd think Page would be in hiding with his lawyers, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. But the eccentric Russophile has spent the last year making nonstop media appearances and testifying in front of House Intelligence Committee members for hours without a lawyer, frequently complaining about his supposed persecution by the Clinton-Obama-Comey regime. When the Nunes memo was released last week, Page took a victory lap, texting a reporter it was a giant historic leap in the repair of America's democracy. Abortion. Are Democrats too extreme? How many elections are Democrats willing to lose to protect late-term abortions? Asked David Brooks in the New York Times. A bill that would have banned abortions after 20 weeks recently went down to defeat in the Senate, with Republicans unable to overcome the Democrats' filibuster. All but three Democratic senators voted against the ban, despite the fact that the politics of abortion are fundamentally bad for Democrats. Most Americans support at least some restrictions on abortion, which makes sense in a world where scientific advances now allow babies to survive outside the womb as early as 22 weeks. Nevertheless, liberals continue to support the unfettered right to an abortion throughout pregnancy. That absolutist position alienates millions of voters. Democrats maintain that late-term procedures are just 1% of all abortion. If that's the case, why prioritize them over all other issues? Democrats should stand up for what is right, even when it makes winning harder, said obstetrician Cheryl Axelrod in Slate.com. Most women who choose to have second-term abortions do so due to the grave health concerns for either mother or fetus that are discovered later in pregnancy. Should a woman be forced to carry a baby to term who will be born without a brain? Or give birth to a child who will suffocate upon delivering because of undeveloped lungs? A choice I faced myself. Yes, second-term abortions make some people uncomfortable, but there is nothing progressive about throwing away the needs of a minority for the comfort of the majority. This issue isn't going away, said Hannah Leventova in MotherJones.com. The pro-life camp has seized on the post-20-week ban as a key tool in its campaign to overturn Roe v. Wade, and 21 states have already passed one, although federal courts have struck it down in two instances. The most recent Senate vote gives Republicans a valuable wedge issue to deploy against red state Democrats Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota and Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri. Democrats should pay a price for their extremism, says Alexandra DeSantis in NationalReview.com. Their stance has hardened into a reflexive opposition to any restrictions on abortion, even though recent polling shows that nearly two-thirds of Americans support a 20-week abortion ban, including half of pro-choice voters. The debate demonstrates exactly how far the left has managed to push the goalposts on abortion. And a quote from Ruth Bader Ginsburg, "This pedestal women are supposed to stand on more often than not turns out to be a cage." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it, and please be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Please give us a call, 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138.